after the publication of the Satanic Verses. Salman Rushdie talks about how he viewed the threats of radical fundamentalism against artists and art, his classic American immigration experience, and how WikiLeaks, Manning, and Snowden fit into the global struggle for free speech. That's Salman Rushdie this Friday at 11 a.m., online at kboo.fm and on your community radio station, KBOO.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by a grant from in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Radio Cab Turkey Project, a hunger relief program providing complete Christmas dinners to families struggling with food insecurity, seniors, the infirm, and those without transportation. Information on how to make donations can be found at radiocabfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Occupy Radio. Tonight's installment will be courtesy of KWVA, the University of Oregon, and your hosts tonight are David Getchy and Rivera Sun, and they interview author Nathan Schneider about his book, Thank You Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. Let's go to them now.
From the Occupy Eugene Media Group, this is Occupy Radio, an extended conversation about the issues which gave rise to the Occupy movement. I'm your host, David Getchy, Sierra Lupe.
I think this was truly an international movement, a transnational movement. In those meetings in Tompkins Square Park, there were people who had been at the movements in Spain, in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Greece, in other places, who were there and who were participating because they saw this idea of Occupy Wall Street as being the American step into the already existing global uprising that was taking place.
Is the apocalypse a fiery time of crisis and doom? Or is it a gentle lifting of a veil, revealing a new world fully formed and relatively crisis-free? Nathan Schneider, author of Thank You Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse, joins Rivera Sun and me as we discuss the Occupy Apocalypse this week on Occupy Radio. Howdy, Occupiers, and welcome to Occupy Radio. You've got me here, Getch, in Eugene, Oregon, and my wonderful co-host, Rivera Sun, in New Mexico.
Hi there, Getch. It's so great to be on the show again.
And always great to have you on the show, as well as Nathan Schneider this week. It was great to have him as well, author of Thank You Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. He got us thinking about where we are today in the revolution and where we are going. And that got me checking out Occupy and where we sit and found a really cool article, If Occupy is a Battle, the First Round was a Success, which kind of goes against a lot of people's feelings on the subject. But he brought up a really good line. This was by Carl Davidson in These Times website, the November 28th, 2013 issue. And I like this line. Occupy was largely an elemental rising of the precariat. Today's new working class, a distressed young generation burdened with debt and facing a precarious future of frequent joblessness in a wider order of savage inequalities, which totally brings everything into perspective for me, Rivera. I'm that's the world that we're in today, and that's why Occupy had such a surge.
I think that one thing about Occupy for me, and especially talking with Nathan Schneider this week, really evoked this, is the sense of the mythic that we experience with it. It's easy to forget that when we're in the midst of six-hour discussions about drum circles and porta-potties. But when we take a step back, which is what these years since the 2011 Occupy uprising
and subsequent
have really brought
police
to
state
us,
crackdown.
Right, always mention that. One of the things that these times have given us is the space to reflect, the space to see what happened on a larger scale and to bring the mythic forward. You know, Nathan, in his book title, says Notes on the Occupy Apocalypse, and then he goes on to define apocalypse in a way that opens your eyes to other possibilities of that word. For me, it made me think about the four horsemen of the biblical apocalypse and how us occupiers might have been unprophesized horsemen of the new version of the apocalypse, which is more of a lifting of a veil or a revealing of knowledge than the gloom and doom perspective brought to us by the Christians.
So one of those horsemen is got drums, obviously. A couple more of them have, I don't know, banners to drop. I'm just seeing these horsemen in a totally different perspective. Like, you know, Nathan was talking about how Occupy was a performance art. I liked that line. So is that the direction you're going with the new apocalypse?
Well, I think the idea of the apocalypse is something unveiling, that we are breaking through veils of delusion in our society, one after another, and behind every veil is corruption and pestilence and fear and corporate control and tyranny. But we have to keep tearing apart those veils, lifting those veils until it all clears out to the vision that lies beyond. And some of us have seen that. It's like Martin Luther King saying, I have been to the mountaintop and I have seen the promised land.
Okay, okay. So the thing I'm looking at, though, is how is this apocalypse different? Because I'm really rooting for this apocalypse to not entail billions of people dying.
Well, that would be the reason we're trying to keep it as a nonviolent struggle.
Well, yeah, a nonviolent struggle where we actually force the governments of the world to do something about the other things that could cause billions of people to die. I mean, it doesn't just have to be because of violence that everybody dies. It could very well be because of radiation from Fukushima or, you know, the effects of climate change and widespread drought and famine.
Right. Well, I think what we're looking at is kind of the apocalypse to end all apocalypses if we go down that route, seeing that climate change really could spell the end for the human species and many other species. But I think that's where the reframing of what this word is all about comes in handy, is to know that within the breakdown of a system is a breakthrough to something new. And that's where we have to really apply our efforts on saying what is coming. What is coming beyond the storm that is now?
Yeah, that's a tough call. And it does take creativity. And that's why I keep coming back to the idea that maybe we can figure something out that is creative, that this struggle isn't really about the change because the change has already happened. It's just the struggle is to get people to realize the change has happened. That's kind of the way I'm seeing the whole apocalypse scenario that Nathan is presenting. And I don't know, Nathan's the guy who is presenting it, so we could just go to Nathan now. What do you say?
He's the expert. Let's ask him.
All righty then. Did we just say something outrageous, occupiers? Or are we not outrageous enough? Let us know what you're thinking. Rivera and I will be hanging out at the Occupy the Media podcast page on Facebook. We do this every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. Pacific. Listen live with us as Occupy Radio plays on KWVA or stream at kwvaradio.org.
Nathan Schneider is an editor for WagingNonviolence.org. He is also the author of a book entitled Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. His essays and articles have appeared in the New York Times, Harper's Magazine, and The Nation. You can also find more of his work on his own blog, which is found at www.therowboat.com.
are with Nathan Schneider, the author of Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. I want to thank you for coming on the show today, Nathan.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here.
As we are as well, we being myself and Rivera Sun. How are you doing today, Rivera?
Oh, lovely. I'm really excited to interview Nathan because he does such good work on so many fronts.
And he helped us to meet George Lakey.
That's true.
Yes.
Which will always endear me to him.
So, Nathan, you have your own personal Occupy story, which mirrors the rise and I'm not quite ready to say fall of Occupy. And then you put it into a book as well. And I want to maybe get a chance to talk about you and the Occupy Apocalypse.
Absolutely. Let's go.
All right. So let's start with your book, I guess. Or how would you like? Would you like to start with the book or the experience?
Well, maybe the place to start is the place where I first encountered Occupy Wall Street. Does that sound good?
Let's do that. Yes.
So in the summer of 2011, something really interesting was in the air. I had just come back from a conference of activists from around the world, and that was in Boston. And I came out of that really excited about not just reporting on, as so many journalists tend to do, reporting on when a movement hits the ground, right, when it's in the streets, but reporting on the process of discussion and preparation and strategy that organizers and activists have to go through, you know, to create a successful movement. And so that summer, in the wake of the Arab Spring and the uprising in Wisconsin, I was looking for a planning process to cover. I was looking for people who were trying to mount something big and to see how they were going to do it. And I was amazed to find that I found not just one, but many different groups of people who were planning to do something that fall and also that summer. First, I found a group that had, since March of 2011, been planning to occupy Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. And what I wasn't aware of is another group was planning to occupy Zuccotti Park and attempted to occupy Zuccotti Park in June of 2011, a group spun off from Anonymous. And it was in that process of starting to talk with these different folks that I found out about the Adbusters call for hashtag Occupy Wall Street. And as I learned more about that, it led me to attend what was the third public planning meeting for Occupy Wall Street in Tompkins Square Park in New York City. And that was about 60 people sitting in a circle under the Hare Krishna tree, the tree where the Hare Krishna religion was founded. And I found myself in the midst of a really exciting and challenging, sometimes frustrating, but just absolutely addictive process.
That's really fascinating, Nathan, because my personal experience with Occupy came about as it was sweeping across the country and just popping up everywhere. And I'll have to admit, I didn't know that there was so much concurrent planning going on ahead of time. And I think that's probably part of the story that many people don't know. Is that something you talk about in your book?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there are lessons from that planning process that help one understand the logic and the shape that Occupy ended up taking on for itself. For instance, a kind of often repeated concern about the movement comes from that initial Adbusters call. At the top, it said, "What is our one demand?" And that was the idea from the Adbusters editors who proposed this idea, but did no actual organizing much beyond that, that there would be lots of people gathering at Wall Street with one demand, right? And that idea excited people, and it brought them to, in New York, to Tompkins Square Park and other places to plan for it. But in the course of those planning meetings, over the course of, these were weekly meetings for about a month and a half, that the idea kind of changed. And it changed because of who was there and because of what they decided made sense for what they wanted to do. They weren't going to just take the Adbusters idea as such and go with it. So one of the things that came out of that process, and actually at the same time in the process of those planning to occupy Freedom Plaza in DC, was distancing themselves from that idea of just one demand, one occupation in one place, kind of like Tahrir Square. And they got much more interested in a different kind of model. They came to recognize that making one demand at that point didn't make a whole lot of sense because they hadn't built the power and the culture of resistance that could really make sure that the demand was met. They instead decided that it was more reasonable to build a movement and to make the focus building that movement and making it spread. So by the last meeting in Tompkins Square Park before the occupation began, the plan had really changed. It was not going to be one occupation with one demand. It was going to be an occupation that would encourage and inspire people all over the place to build their own occupations and to start discussions about their own demands. And that's exactly what happened. It was amazing how quickly that was what happened and how different it was from Adbusters, from what Adbusters had really called for. If you understand that process and the reasoning for that process and for those decisions, you know, I think a lot of the criticism and a lot of the media torpedoing that was happening in the early weeks of Occupy, you know, is really undercut. And it's a shame, I think, that that process of reasoning wasn't more available for people to understand what was really going on.
So it sounds to me like you're saying, Nathan, that Occupy's trajectory, aside from getting massively clamped down on by the police state, Occupy's trajectory actually followed its intended course.
Yeah, it followed the intended course of the people who came together and met and tried to figure out what really made sense for them. And I think that's really important, especially when people claim that the movement just couldn't come up with the one demand, you know, that was some kind of failure or that was some kind of blindness. I think it's important to recognize that that was a conscious decision, and I think actually a pretty wise one.
It sounds like to me, and also in my experience as we went along, that the one demand came out of sort of a older paradigm of activism. Not that it's invalid, but that we had a whole trajectory of activism that Occupy kind of said, let's rethink this. Let's do this a little different. Can you talk about those distinctions between the two?
Well, it's interesting, and I'm still kind of trying to wrap my mind around what's new and what's old in all of this. I mean, there was a sense in which in the early stages of Occupy, people did feel like this was the first time this was ever, anything like this had ever happened, and that was part of what was so exciting about it, or that it had ever been done this way. But in the course of it, for Waging Nonviolence, a website that I'm an editor for, I was working with older activists, people like George Lakey, who you mentioned before, and Mary Elizabeth King, who was part of the civil rights movement. And they really didn't see what was going on as being so shocking. And they really recognized it from past movements that they'd been part of. So I think this sense of the ambiguity of the early stages of a movement is very common, actually. And it's also very common for critics on the outside to attack it for that. You know, Mary King, and, you know, reflecting on her experience in the civil rights movement, you know, kept saying to me as I was raising these questions about what was going on with Occupy, she kept saying, yeah, we were doing all this same stuff and they were criticizing us in the same way. And when they look back on it now, they pretend that it wasn't complicated and that Martin Luther King came down from the clouds and, you know, led us all to victory, but that wasn't the case at all. So I think in some ways, what makes us think that this is new and that this is really different is the extent to which the histories of our movements has been forgotten.
That's a really great point. I know a lot of people think that Rosa Parks just got tired and sat down on the bus, when really she'd been training with a whole group of other people long in advance, and the boycott was actually planned and instigated. What about the public nature of this, to hold these discussions of formation and strategy and group occupation as part of the early stages of building a movement in a public place?
I think a really important way of thinking about what Occupy began as begins with recognizing that a lot of the people who were leading this process were actually artists. You know, one of the most important figures in crafting the shape that the occupation would take was a performance artist from Greece named Georgios Sagri, but there were many others. And so I think they were thinking of what they were doing in the ways that an artist is used to thinking. They were trying to create a performance that would open people's minds. And I think that's what a lot of these discussions were about. They were, on the one hand, a discussion about stuff, an attempt to hear people out and so forth, but they were also always a way of enacting a certain kind of ideal, of doing a performance that juxtaposed with Wall Street and with the corrupt government would reveal that corruption and show a glimpse of what democracy is really supposed to look like. And that was a very powerful action. It was a very powerful performance, and it spread in the way that art does, which is virally. It spread through inspiration, not necessarily through creating new chapters of kind of static organizations like more political activists like to do. But I also think we have to recognize the limits of performance in the process, and that while performance can be incredibly powerful and really can shift the imagination and the discourse as Occupy did, you know, there are ways in which it also needs to be backed up by other kinds of organizing, other kinds of discussion and strategizing and mobilizing. And I think that's, you know, what a lot of people who were activated by this movement are trying to do now.
Your book, it talks about the Occupy Apocalypse, you know, Thank You Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. And you're approaching it in the same way that Robert Jensen has, and I'm sure that people have compared you to due to his use of the term apocalypse as the raising, the lifting of the veil, which, or the unveiling, I think is how you refer to it, Nathan. And it seems to me that that would probably be the model that you're looking at then, wouldn't it be? The idea that we don't actually have to go into the battle so much as just reveal the world that is behind that veil.
You know, I think there's only so much an apocalypse can do, but yes, that's exactly the sense in which I'm trying to use that word, or one of the senses at least. That just goes back to the Greek etymology. You know, as you say, Bob Jensen has been exploring in his work, and he and I have been in conversation over the years as well. But that sense of apocalypse as unveiling, as revealing, I think is really a way of articulating the goal of what I wanted to do with the book, was to give an account of that unveiling. And it took place for people in a couple of different ways. One is in unveiling the depth of injustice in this society. You know, a lot of people came into the movement with a kind of vague or particular sense of what was wrong. You know, maybe we need a constitutional amendment, or maybe we need this kind of law to be passed and that would fix everything. And through the movement, a lot of people came into contact with a deeper sense of what is wrong. Part of that in New York, for instance, was with a lot of white people coming to understand the nature of police violence in the city, to become educated about the stop and frisk policy, which now, thanks to that education, I think, is starting to recede and is starting to be confronted in really effective ways. There was another kind of revelation, too, though, and that's the revelation of their sense of possibility, of thinking of politics beyond just choosing between the options offered by politicians.
Oh, yes.
And it's like thinking about it in terms of what we can build from the ground up and the options that we create for ourselves. That's another really important sense of apocalypse. And the third, really, I think, is that kind of more colloquial sense, which is a sense of imagining oneself at the precipice of the end of the world. And there were ways in which this movement really enacted that too. And, you know, sometimes for better in terms of inspiring people with a sense of urgency and agency in what might otherwise seem like an impossible moment, but also, you know, really taking them to the extremes of their capacities and kind of pushing them off a cliff that sometimes led to a lot of disappointment and frustration.
Do you think that process of the unveiling, which the unveiling apocalypse definition is still in process, is still going on, maybe even for more people than were directly involved in the Occupy movement?
You know, I hope so. I'm still kind of trying to figure that out. I think that there are ways in which this apocalypse might be spreading. When we look at things like the low-wage worker campaigns that are going on, in many cases being led and aided by people who are activated in the Occupy movement, you know, one hopes that there's an apocalypse is spreading to different sectors of society that the Occupy movement wasn't able to reach. But I think there are other ways in which the veil has been lowered again, in which people are kind of back to a sense of business as usual and don't feel that sense of possibility of a politics more of their own making.
I could give you a metaphor for that. Since we're talking about the veil lifting and how it dropped back down again, you know, when you get a little breeze blowing on a veil, it'll start to make it flap a little bit before it actually blows it away. So maybe that was just a small breeze ahead of a much bigger gust.
Yeah, it could be. And I think, you know, if you look at the history of social movements in the past, they often begin with that kind of messy, very horizontal, very kind of anarchic outpouring, a really exciting and important moment that sets the stage for other things. But then the question of what it all amounts to, you know, gets determined later as people figure out whether they can really sustain that gust, you know, sustain that work and move it on to new stages. And I think that's a real open question. And that is not something that we should be asking as spectators, you know, asking, will those occupiers get their act together and produce change in more concrete ways? That's the way it's often being framed and phrased. I think the question is, what can everybody in this society do to make what is a value in that rupture last and stick and make it real. It requires more participation. It requires new forms of participation and organizing. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
It seems to me, and you mentioned this before, that our populace, our national populace, has lost a real valuable part of their history. And I won't go so far as to say whether it's been intentional or not, but we don't know the history that led to the suffrage movement, the labor movement, the civil rights movement. What can we do right now to not lose the wisdom that was gained through the Occupy movement's success or failures as they are, besides reading your wonderful book, Thank You, Anarchy? What else can we do?
It's a great point, you know, and I think it has to be done at every level of society, of history, of family. I do think there's an intentionality to this, you know, that the history of social movements in this country has been purposely forgotten and erased. And then a lot of people unintentionally have perpetuated that and followed through. We have to recognize that every time we, you know, when we talk about the vital moments of American history, there is a history underneath that. And I think one way of doing that is to rethink what causes history to happen. You know, look at a film like Lincoln, right, which portrays the emancipation, the end of slavery, as a process enacted by a group of white men holding particular kinds of office. And that's one part of the story, and that's usually how the story is told. But what is missing from that is the incredible popular movements that made them even forced to have the conversation in the first place, a conversation which they themselves did not want to have. Lincoln did not want to have that conversation. We have to start thinking about history from the ground up, thinking about the movements, thinking about what compels those in power to make change, what forces them to. And when you scratch the surface of every moment in our history, you find those untold histories of popular movements. And when you tell those histories, when you recognize the power of those forces, you recognize the power that we actually can hold today. And so I think it means reconsidering every piece of our global story and remembering that, you know, the popular power is really the true power in the world, and that popular power is at work throughout history, even though it's often so powerfully unacknowledged.
Getch and I spend a lot of time talking about our definition of America in the United States, but also within that conversation is the definition of ourselves. For so long, you know, and our history tells it this way, we've been an identity of predominantly white males conquering definitely the Northern Hemisphere, and now we're global. And a lot of Americans feel a deep sense of shame about the way that this has gone on. And do you think part of the suppression of our history of us continuing waves of populace who have pushed for justice and equality, do you think we can find a deeper sense of identity as an American people within that story?
Well, I think one can, for sure. And there is a sense in which that is an American story. You know, one can think of Walt Whitman and his deep sense of democracy as a kind of particularly American enterprise. But I think it's also important, and this was something I saw so much in the Occupy movement, was a desire to move beyond simply rewriting American history or rethinking the American future, but thinking of these things globally. And, you know, none of the statements passed by any of the Occupy assemblies that I ever looked at mentioned the word borders. They just didn't mention it. I think this was truly an international movement, a transnational movement. In those meetings in Tompkins Square Park, there were people who had been at the movements in Spain, in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Greece, in other places, who were there and who were participating because they saw this idea of Occupy Wall Street as being the American step into the already existing global uprising that was taking place. And I think a lot of people at the core of this movement thought of themselves in those terms, in that very global sense. And I think it's important when we look at movements as coming from the ground up to recognize the international connections. And borders and national identity are often part of the story that's told by those in power and by those in control. And the popular story, the story of people's movements, is often a much more international one in which borders are more porous and identity is more disparate and actually much more interesting, more human, and more humane.
I've been looking at the TPP negotiations as they move along and start to identify the block of corporate nation states, I guess, or a single corporate nation state. And my thinking reflected back on what you were just saying, how our activist movements have to become more globalized and international. But the TPP, while it's global in its impact, is regional. And it seems to me that's where our next step is. You know, we need to think globally, act locally. But I think also now it's time to start embracing different regions and start to find our allies, you know, in the blocks that are responding to different international corporate pressures, I guess you can say, because the different areas of the world are going to be impacted by the corporate, international corporate state differently. And so I think that's the next step that we move into, is we need to reflect what the TPP, what the different corporations are doing and how they are building up their alliances. And we need to build up similar alliances.
Yeah, absolutely. And one way of telling the story of what Occupy is as an outgrowth, a kind of delayed outgrowth of the of what has often been called the anti-globalization movement, but which is really a counter-globalization movement. It's in a, you know, this movement that emerged in the 90s in particular was a recognition that capital was spreading globally and was operating in global terms, and that people were spreading globally and operating in global terms. And so the movement that worked to build power from the ground up had to offer another vision of globalization than the one that the corporate and political ruling class wanted to create. And that's something that's a challenge we're really confronting today. And when you look at these trade agreements that keep coming out, you know, we have to think about what kind of trade agreements would we want? What kind of transnational organizations and bodies would we want? And how can we start creating them now? For instance, and I like how you're thinking regionally, you know, how can we reframe a debate about immigration in the U.S. to one about migration and one, you know, recognizing the realities of Central and South America that compel people to move to the United States and to send money back. You know, we never talk about that in the U.S. discourse. You know, you see articles in the media about migrants once they arrive and the challenges they face, but we never recognize the ways in which it's our policies that are driving them here in the first place. And for instance, in Waging Nonviolence's coverage of the immigration debates, we've really worked closely with a reporter working in Mexico who's been chronicling this migration issue from the other side of the border. And, you know, our movements have to do that, too.
We'll get back to Nathan Schneider, author of Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse, in just a couple of minutes. But first, Rivera and I need to discuss some of our own apocalyptic visions. You're listening to Occupy Radio from KWVA and the Pacifica Radio Network, streaming at kwvaradio.org and podcasting at occupythemedia.podomatic.com. I'm your host, David Getchy, Sierra Lupe.
Getch, we've been talking with Nathan about this apocalypse, so I have a question for you. Uh-huh. In the very beginning, you talked about the change is already here, that all we have to do is lift off this veil and the change is waiting like a statue underneath that's just being revealed. Do you really think that's true? Is the change already done?
I don't think the change is done per se. I mean, you know, obviously change doesn't finish. You know, change happens on a continuum. So I don't think the change is done. And, you know, the real question for me is one of what are we unveiling? What is happening through this unveiling? And, you know, if we're talking about apocalypse being an unveiling, that means there's something that has to be unveiled. And that, in this case, in a revolutionary case, that something is a new world, I would think. Don't you?
Oh, definitely. I like this idea that, you know, for me, it was like the lifting of the veil shows the horror behind the scenes. But now you're saying eventually we lift the veil and we see the new dawn coming.
Oh, yeah.
And that it's already fomenting behind the horizon of now. That somewhere just around the corner, just beyond this darkest moment that we're in, dawn is coming.
I would even say that dawn is here. And that's the thing that we're really looking at now is we're busy, you know, in this big struggle to create a change that is already present. I mean, you know, it will manifest in even greater degrees as time goes by, but all of the ingredients of the new world that we want to live in are already present in this world, and we're busy fighting over the scraps of the old world. And so I think the unveiling is the realization that there's really nothing left to fight about, that it's done, and now it's really just about settling in and really understanding the benefits of this new world.
That's really a very inspiring vision. I think in my novel, in The Dandelion Insurrection, one of the characters says that this government, this world situation that we're in, it looks fiery and it looks really powerful, but it's really a flaring sunset on its way out. And every form of repression, every extreme action that it does, the madness that we're seeing unfolding with our political situation is actually a sign that it's sinking. It's a sinking ship setting off its distress flares.
And you'll notice on a sinking ship, there's a lot of activity. You know, there's very rarely on a sinking ship, people just like, oh yeah, look at that. It's a time of action. And that's what we're seeing. There's a lot of action on the sinking ship. The only trouble is, hopefully, we have a lot of really good life rafts. And in my analogy, the life rafts are even better than the sinking ship. So I got to work that into this whole metaphor to really make it that positive thing I was shooting for.
Well, you know, one thing about the sinking ship and the activity going on is that at some point, enough of us wake up and we look around and we say, yeah, there isn't much life or chance of life if we stay put where we are. We need to get out our oars, get out our paddles, jump in the water and swim for something new. And I think, you know, I think I've been seeing signs of that on the horizon. Occupy was certainly one big, you know, running up from the underbelly of the ship saying, there's a hole in the ship. And now we need more. In the spring, I've heard lots of rumors of action for the spring, coordinated actions for the spring. There was posts on popularresistance.org. Many people have been talking about this, and I'm very intrigued to find out what's brewing on our horizon.
I like the concept. The concept is worldwide, just waves of actions. And they're not coordinated in the essence like there's a grand committee at the top of this pyramid that is saying, do this and do that. Basically, it's just saying, other people are going to be doing something. Why don't you? And I like that concept. You know, it gets a lot of people going. It builds up a lot of momentum, and it can really carry things into new and astonishing directions. So that's a pretty exciting thing.
Yeah, well, you know me, Getch. I'm a strategy girl. I love strategy. And I like to encourage people to become really well-versed in how we look at what's going on from a strategic perspective and be able to be versed enough in nonviolent struggle and strategy to be able to respond quickly to an unfolding situation and not just pit our efforts futilely against this big epic thing that we're up against, but to be able to, in the moment, instantly know exactly what needs to be done. I think we can do that as a populace. I think we have the skills, and the knowledge is certainly here in the world for us to use.
I agree. And that's why Occupy popped up. That's why I loved that line about the precariat, because the people in whatever that low part of the ship, you know, are the youth of today. And the youth of today are faced with a really lousy situation compared to when I was that age. And, you know, when I was that age, you know, when I was in my early 20s was the early 80s, and things weren't all that great. We had double-digit unemployment and such. But it's even worse now because so much of the governmental supports are gone. So that's where we're going now with Nathan, you know, in that discussion, where the precariat are about to take us. And I say we go into Nathan Part 2. What do you say?
Let's go. When we're looking around on a global perspective, what do we see brewing? What's in the works? I mean, it would be arrogant to assume that we're going to propel the next wave that may already be happening. So what do you see that's out there?
I think there are a lot of things going on a lot of different levels. You know, on the one hand, there's these struggles for democracy, for what the Spanish 15M movement called real democracy now. And that's really, I think, the impulse that drove so many of the 2011 movements. And that's really playing out now, most of all, in the resistance to the surveillance, the transnational surveillance state that's emerging now, and that we're seeing, especially through the leaks of Edward Snowden and so forth. You know, that's one struggle that I think is so important. Another that's been in the news a lot lately, in particular, is a struggle against extractive energy and against the fossil fuel industry, for the struggle for a world that is sustainable and that people will be able to inhabit in a few generations, and that isn't going to throw the most vulnerable populations, you know, under the bus of climate change. And with the conference in Poland, once again, we saw people from the most vulnerable communities in the world rising up and demanding that there be international agreements that respect the planet and that respect the environment and that respect fellow human beings. Those and so many others, labor struggles around the world, the renewal of a kind of anti-sweatshop movement, you know, where we're recognizing the ways in which corporations feeding on American consumerism are dooming people around the world to incredibly dangerous working conditions. The real challenge, I think, among these movements and among also the many, many different struggles for justice reflected in the U.S. is to figure out how to connect them again, you know, and to help them empower one another rather than seeming fragmented, and to recognize that these are all really part of a common struggle. You know, I think that's the challenge and something that a lot of activists in the U.S. and around the world are trying to figure out.
There's two directions I could go right now, Nathan. I really want to explore the anarchy part of Thank You, Anarchy. But because it follows what you were just saying, I want to jump in. You're fairly closely enmeshed, I guess, with the actual OWS part of Occupy, the actual Wall Street part of Occupy. But you've taken the time to give, I think, a national overview of the movement as well. So where do you see the seed that Occupy represents growing into this next stage of crisis, or, you know, of revolution, we'll say?
You know, then during the height of Occupy and now, I'm constantly aware of, no matter how much I learn and try to keep tabs on things, there's always so much that I'm missing. But in terms of what's going on now in the U.S., for instance, I think there's a lot of ambivalence. On the one hand, a lot of people who were activated in Occupy came out feeling frustrated and feeling disempowered, you know, because they were, you know, A, crushed by a national policing campaign coordinated by Homeland Security, and B, because, you know, the movement wasn't able to build the structures of resiliency to make a way through that. But on the other hand, there are people who are activated by the movement who have gone into a variety of different campaigns. You know, just the other day, I heard a report back from a group that's working on uniting different anti-fracking direct action groups across the Marcellus Shale region where fracking is happening, you know, thinking about their region in the same regional terms rather than state or local terms that the gas companies are thinking of it in. You know, you're looking at, once again, a whole clusters, people going off into movements in many places, in many cases, working in communities with people who are most affected, rather than just sitting in encampments in the centers of cities where the people really aren't. You know, I think many of the best impulses among those activated in Occupy have been to go to the front lines and to put the most affected people at the front of these struggles and to try to support them somehow. This is also struggles about immigration, about police brutality and discrimination, about labor protections for low-wage workers. You know, all of these struggles that are environmentalism as well, all of these struggles that are ongoing have been strengthened by that kind of, as I call it, the Occupy diaspora. But once again, there's that question of, are they going to be able to draw a thread from one struggle to another and unite them in another moment that feels like, you know, a true momentum that they can make together, but that they can't make separately for each other and for themselves?
I like to look at what we had going on at Occupy Eugene. On October 15th, 2011, we marched between 2,500 and 3,000 people around town, and then moved into the park blocks and set up our occupation. And so we marched, we'll say 2,500 people, and then that night 250 people camped. And, you know, that was our population in our camp for the next 3 months, was somewhere in that 200 to 300 range. And then the camp got broken up and we dropped down to 50 or 60 people. And so, you know, we needed those big numbers for marching in the streets. And then we needed, you know, not as big, but substantial numbers for making the statement of the occupation. But once all that was gone, it was those 50 or 60 people at the core who had been activated and continued to carry on the work. And we can easily call back those 300 people or those 3,000 people when the time is right. So I figure that's Occupy in the microcosm and the macrocosm.
Yeah, I think that's true. Though calling them back, I think, you know, is also a challenge, and it requires thinking about what makes people really want to participate. You know, and participation, according to the studies of, say, Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stephan and their important landmark book, How Civil Resistance Works, participation is really the key predictor of the success or failure of a popular movement. Is the more participation in a society it can muster, the more powerful and effective it will be. So what brings about participation? Is it just making a call? I think what really made, you know, Occupy so powerful is the way in which it created something for people that people needed and wanted. It created an inspiring space. It gave people things to do together, and it helped them feel more powerful than they were apart. I think now we have to think about other kinds of participation as well, and other reasons for participation, because Occupy really just activated a pretty small segment of American society. A lot of people were left out, people often with families and jobs, substandard jobs, but jobs. And, you know, we have to think about ways of building a movement that people will really feel represented by and served by, that they can really participate in and plug into in ways beyond just what Occupy was able to do, which in itself was so tremendous, but, you know, which also left many gaps. So I think that's really a challenge, and to think about what kind of movement this society really needs and what movement people will be able to participate in and gain power through.
I think one thing I witness is that people are actually fairly willing to do something when it's clear and made, I would say, easy to moderate to do. In that range, people are actually kind of willing to participate. So I guess my question is twofold. I guess it's about both parts of your book, the title of your book, Thank You, Anarchy. How does anarchy and the whole notion of anarchy play into this dynamic of getting a populace that is probably not very anarchistically inclined, I would hazard a guess, involved in a movement such as Occupy? And then the other part of the question is about this Occupy apocalypse, which you say is the unveiling. What is the vision that is seen beyond the unveiling? That's something that could pull people into action.
Yeah, those are such big questions.
Sorry.
But right at the end of the show, too.
Yeah, but there was something so powerful about the anarchistic quality of Occupy. You know, there was a big march that the unions put on just before, a few months before in May of 2011 on Wall Street with 20,000 people, just like Adbusters wanted for Occupy. And it seemed to have all the makings of something people could easily participate in and show up for, and they did, but nobody reported it. It didn't make any impact, really. And it stood in such stark contrast to the kind of anarcho-participatory excitement that came up with Occupy with just a few hundred people in the beginning. I think there is a sense in which that anarchistic way of organizing is exciting for people. I think on the one hand, so many of us don't really know how to participate in it because we're used to operating very differently. But we recognize in it a kind of strong form of values that we already hold. And I think it's important to remember that anarchism itself emerged not, you know, in the 80s with the Black Bloc or whatever, but it emerged as part of the Enlightenment, at least in the West. It emerged as a kind of extreme form, extreme in a good way, I think, of the kinds of democratic and egalitarian ideals that our society is supposedly built on. And I think what was so powerful about the anarchism that was kind of embedded in the practice of Occupy and the other movements going on at the same time around the world was that it called our institutions to task And it, you know, reminded us what democracy is really supposed to be about, you know, what transparency really can look like. And so even though a lot of us don't know, you know, how to practice as anarchists, really, and it's incredibly hard and takes generations of work, you know, it was exciting and inspiring. The title for me, Thank You Anarchy, was on the one hand a tribute to that. But on the other hand, I think there's a way in which one can read it kind of sarcastically, like, thanks very much, anarchy. You know, and I think a lot of people came away feeling frustrated with the anarchic qualities of the movement and wanted something, you know, with different kinds of structures that they knew better how to participate in. And I think that's going to be an open question going forward. What's the role for the kind of prefigurative work, the kind of apocalypse-making work that the anarchic approach created? And what's the role for stuff that's a little easier for people to wrap their heads around in the here and now that can help us take steps toward empowering ourselves and, you know, and strengthening our communities?
Well, I think a key thing is looking forward, which, Nathan, I really appreciate that that has been your attitude, that it's not about lingering in the past, that it's now about creating a vision and manifesting that vision. So I like that that has been the vision that you've been communicating.
Oh, yeah. You know, I wrote this book. I wasn't really intending to do the book, but at one point it came to really feel like it was important for people to have a way to look back, not with nostalgia, but with a recognition of what was accomplished in order to be able to move forward. And I hope that this book in some small way contributes to that, to helping people remember what Occupy inspired them to do, you know, how it change people's thinking, and then also, you know, to remember how far there still is to go and to put that work behind us and move forward in ways, in different ways that, you know, are suited to the present and to the future.
That's the challenge for all of us, everybody who wants to change the world, I think. Yeah, it's looking into the future and determining what you want to see happening there. Like Rivera said, what's beyond the veil? And is that already there? But right now, I want to make sure everybody knows we are talking with Nathan Schneider, the author of Thank You Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. I want to thank you for coming on the show today, Nathan. And I want to give you a chance. We've got a couple more minutes before we have to say goodbye. And I want to make sure that you get anything else that you want to make sure our listeners hear out there in front of our listeners' ears.
Yeah, I think the really important thing, and I appreciate this conversation a lot, but I think the really important thing to emphasize is that this is only over, this apocalypse is only over if we let it be, and if we sit around waiting for other people to finish it for us. If anything excited any of us about what the Occupy movement was doing and saying and calling for, you know, we have to, you know, strengthen our efforts to try to enact that in our communities and keep the wave growing and building in new ways, in ways that make sense to us and that help us to serve one another and hear from one another better than we can now.
Well, Nathan, this has been such an eye-opening conversation for me. I have not had a chance to read your book yet, but I am going to, because you reframed my own experience in and through the Occupy movement in several new ways today, and I really just appreciate that so much.
Well, good. I'm really glad to have had this conversation, and thank you so much for hosting it and for keeping this rupture going.
Did you say rupture or rapture?
Rupture. We haven't seen the rapture yet.
Okay.
And that's apparently part of the apocalypse.
Depends who you ask, but yeah, it seems to be in there somewhere.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on the show, Nathan. This has truly been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you. Thanks for hosting it.
Folks, you can find out more about Nathan Schneider and his book, Thank You Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse, on his blog, www.theroboat.com. And if you want to send him a message, you can email him at nathan@theroboat.com. You listening to Occupy Radio, Occupiers. And if you are not listening live, that means you have found the Occupy the Media podcast. Congratulations and welcome to the show. Now you can get 6 Occupy and social justice podcasts each week. Monday, Mic Check Radio. Tuesday, People Rise Up Radio. Wednesday, Occupy Territory America. Thursday, Talk Nation Radio. Friday, Air Occupy. And every Saturday, listen to yours truly on Occupy Radio. OccupyTheMedia.podomatic.com or search Occupy the Media on iTunes.
This is when we like to talk about what's going on in listener feedback, and this time it's more like a guest feedback, because during the Wednesday chat, your sister Leah Rivera brought up the concept of sovereignty as a way to, I don't know, allocate farmland in Maine, and I know I'm not quite getting it right, so I don't fully understand what the issue was that she was raising.
Well, sovereignty is a really complicated issue, and it also means a lot of different things. If you talk to Indigenous group or First Nations group, sovereignty has a very specific meaning within the context of sovereign nations. Leah was using it more, I think, in a local self-governance sovereignty movement, which also has many different ways that it works across the U.S. But in Maine, there's a lot of notion of self-reliance, independence that get wrapped into that notion of sovereignty, the notion that the state and the federal government shouldn't get to determine our lives. And this is really key because on the 18th, as you know, Getch, we're going to have Thomas Lindsay, the director of Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, come on and talk about the community rights ordinances that are sweeping across the country and how this revolutionary new form is giving sovereignty back to people in small communities.
That is something I'm looking forward to. Yet another one of the great guests that you have been able to wrangle for us on Occupy Radio, Rivera. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah. And that is the other revolution that I'm trying to foment is the Occupy Radio revolution. You know, for most of this year, it's just been me. And then you very happily joined me on the show. And I want to keep that going. I want to find ways to bring more people who are listening right now into your spot as a co-host. And you and I have been talking about that a little bit, and I kind of feel like you're starting to understand where I'm going.
You have a vision for this, Getch, and you got to go and follow it. And that means people who are listening, if you have wanted to be a host on a radio show, particularly Occupy Radio show, you shouldn't be scared of us, and you should contact Getch and let him know that you would like to do what we do.
Yes, yes. And that is an excellent, excellent lead-in to me telling people how to contact us. So I'm going to go ahead and do that. All of you occupiers can reach us by telephone at 541-632-4092. You can also go to our Podomatic page and click on the Call Me button, and that is occupythemedia.podomatic.com. You can also get in touch with us through Gmail and Twitter at OccupyRadio23, and you can reach us on Facebook at the Occupy the Media podcast page. Occupy Radio is produced through KWVA 88.1 FM on the campus of the University of Oregon. Louisa Anderson is our producer, and we have support from OEMG, the Occupy Eugene Media Group.
We want to say thanks this week to Nathan Schneider, author of Thank You, Anarchy, and also thank you to my co-host, David Getchy Sierra Lupe.
How about giving us a call, occupiers, at 541-632-4092. We would love to hear from you and love to play your beautiful voice on the radio. You can drop us a line at OccupyRadio23 on Twitter and Gmail. Find us on Facebook on the Occupy the Media podcast page, and we are occupythemedia.podomatic.com.
For Occupy Radio, I'm Rivera Sun, and the apocalypse is at hand, y'all, so let's tear down a few veils between now and when I talk to you next week.
This has been Occupy Radio. I'm Jimmy Tardy, and tonight you heard from David Getchy, Rivera Sun from KWVA, which is out of the University of Oregon. They were interviewing Nathan Schneider about his book, Thank You Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. Thanks for listening.
It's 7:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hey, KBOO supporters, we just sent you a card, so watch your mailbox. It's an opportunity to give a little more assistance at this time of year to your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station. Yep, tax time. That means that your donation makes a difference, and it'll really make a difference for KBOO because you can help us qualify for Oregon Cultural Trust matching funds. You can get more information about this on our website at kboo.fm/year-end-gift-2013.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Triangle production of American Fiesta, starring Gary Wayne Cash, a witty, hopeful tale of imperfection and acceptance. American Fiesta will take place at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. This Triangle production will run from November 29th through December 22nd. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.